Well, the president thinks coronavirus got loose from a Chinese bio lab and that China stole all our jobs. So I think it's time to talk about China, 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 China. In podcast 924, the Bob Davis Podcasts. There's a lot of real estate stuff going on despite all the quarantines, which I think is interesting. If you're buying or selling, if you have rental problems, if you are an owner of real estate property and you are having problems getting your rent collected, or you're having problems let's say you're a contractor, you're having problems getting paid, or you are a renter and you're having problems with your landlord, what you need is a great real estate attorney, whether it's first house, lake home, rental property, rent issues, downsizing, construction issues, contractor liens, things of that nature. Do you have an attorney available to help you out? Do you know what you're signing? And this is where LaCroix Law comes in. Tim LaCroix has the experience and knowledge for people, because of course real estate can be complex. Tim LaCroix is somebody I work with, and I can tell you that this guy can really help people, because the truth is, when handed a pen, people often sign things they don't understand. They don't forget the most important step. Get Tim LaCroix, LaCroix Law, real estate attorneys, residential, commercial, contractor and construction, residential rentals, mortgage and community associations. All of these things can cause headaches for us right now. So here's what you do. Call Tim LaCroix at 763-226-0758, 763-226-0758, or you can click on the banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. It takes you to Tim's LinkedIn page, and you can send him a DM, and you can go from there. Very excited to welcome the independently owned and operated community-focused refueling station at 36th and Lindale Avenue in the Lynn Lake neighborhood in Minneapolis. I've been going there for years, drove by that place for years when I lived in Uptown. Not only are the guys at 36 and Lynn refueling out to help the community, they feature a great selection of locally sourced products in the store. They're always talking about it, from the coffee to burritos and other awesome food to go. It's not your normal convenience store or gas station type place. Remember, 36 and Lynn, next time you swing through Minneapolis and need gas or a cup. For more info and great 36 Lynn events, check them out online at 36. Lynn.com, or click on their banner at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. It's 36lyn.com. Real quick, you know, I could tell you all about where to get the podcast and things like that, but if you're listening to the podcast, you either got it at iTunes or Spotify or something like that. But I really want to thank the Petrangelos for donating a ton of money to the Bob Davis Podcasts, like $100. Thank you guys again for your support, and thanks everyone for donations to the Bob Davis Podcasts for Mobile Podcast Command. More about that later. Appreciate the donations. And if you want to, click on the big yellow donate button at the Bob Davis Podcast. Look for the picture of Mobile Podcast Command. You're good to go. Okay, let's get into it. A little earlier in the day for podcast recording, and so you might hear sirens and other stuff. Usually it's pretty late at night when I record, but I'm recording a little earlier in the day. And before I get started on the podcast, some disclaimers. First of all, China is a tyranny. There's no argument on this end of things about that. The Communist Party in China controls the state. Unfortunately, given the climate of our time at the outset, it needs to be said by me that I don't support this kind of government. The way things are today, if you say anything that isn't a definitive statement that you're not a communist, people think you're a communist. I don't support any overbearing centralized state control anywhere, and especially not even in the United States. It doesn't matter any state not dedicated to maintaining and improving unalienable basic human rights like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as defined in our Declaration of Independence here in the United States, I'm not for. So let's just start that with the outset of this whole thing. Now, a little history about China. And I think this is important for us to think about. China views Sun Yat-sen as the founder of both the Chinese nationalist government and the Chinese communist government. While Yat-sen was an advocate of democracy, it's interesting, in the research for this podcast, I learned that the nationalist government, the KMT, quickly convulsed after formation, and China became a one-party state pretty quickly, headed by General Chiang Kai-shek. Later, even when Chiang Kai-shek went to Formosa or Taiwan and ran the nationalist Chinese government, which still exists as Taiwan, Taiwan was a one-party state until the 1990s. So people like to think of the KMT as a democracy, but that is hardly the truth. KMT's formation in the early 1900s, in other words, the nationalist government of China, was to wrest power from the warlords and the last emperor of China. So China overthrew its monarchy before Russia. China endured revolution and counter-revolution for 50 years before the communists finally defeated Chiang Kai-shek in 1949. This is a story that has been repeated throughout late history. And by saying late history, I mean the 1700s, 1800s, and 1900s. Very few countries in Europe and Asia were able to create states stable enough to endure in those early days, whether it was Russia or Germany or, even France had its issues with overthrowing the monarchy. So it isn't a partisan statement to reinforce the idea that our founders here in the United States created a truly exceptional thing in the United States. Generally speaking, democratic institutions and the federal system survived relatively free of violent convulsions, with the exception of the American Civil War, since the founding. I don't have time to get into the difference between the original Republic of the United States and the result of the American Civil War. So you'd have to look into that. But we are certainly not free of our own convulsions, although they weren't as serious as they were in Europe. We didn't have to overthrow a monarchy here in the United States, even though we did wrest control of our continent, so to speak, from a monarch. So moving forward, the U.S. Depression from 1929 to 1939, and this is really important when it comes to talking about trade and China and threats. The Depression did not end until the end of World War II, and it has often been said, well, it was the war production that pulled us out of World War II. That's not really what it was. It wasn't war production that ended the Depression. The United States, quote, won World War II. We were the only country that escaped bombing and destruction. So the Allies or Axis powers, regardless of who did it and at what point in the war it happened, essentially blew up most of the world's mining, agricultural production, transportation, manufacturing, and infrastructure in the war. This is how devastating World War II was, even compared to World War I. So I didn't mention World War I other than to say that was sort of the beginning of a lot of these changes in Europe with monarchy and so forth. But World War I was also destructive, but not on the level of World War II. World War II was truly a world war, truly deeply destructive to Europe especially and to Asia. So at the end of World War II, the United States was alone in the world, with some minor exceptions, as the only superpower and the only country that had an untouched productive capability. So whether it was agriculture or manufacturing or advertising or movies, made in America was the mantra. American cars, American planes, American consumer products, American steel, American music, movies, American banks. Everybody, it's interesting to see the old pictures from the 1950s because all the world leaders were driving Cadillacs most of the time, except for the British that drove Rolls Royces. And they did have some manufacturing capacity left, but nothing on the level as our factories, which were running at full tilt at the end of the war. By 1960, and I think this is significant, the United States had a 40% share of the world economy, the Rosetta Stone for those who believe in trade protection. In other words, life in the 1960s, the early 60s and the mid to late 50s, once we got things up and running again and became the real leader of the world economy because our factories were running 24 hours a day and we had full employment, from Madison Avenue to Wall Street to Main Street and the farms. If you wanted anything, you bought it from the United States. This produced this Rosetta Stone for people who want to go back to those days, who believe that we can go back to those days, this unprecedented prosperity. And yes, we did do it in the sense that we blew up the rest of the world. And I'm not saying we did it on purpose. We did, but we had to in order to win World War II, right? But it did not mean that our system in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and even as late as the 1980s, as we really learned, it didn't mean that our system was efficient or better. So in the second half of this podcast, we're going to talk about this whole situation with trade and China and the coronavirus and the current Republican and really Trump supporter approach to this whole situation. Well, it is starting to heat up. We had a little bit of a heat wave, went up to 70, and Minnesotans wanted to turn on their air conditioning. If this is you, you can check your AC at 70, and you should, because you want to look at the box back in the back, make sure it's not obstructed. If you have problems with plumbing or heating or air conditioning, you want reliable service. For years, I've been telling you that means Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. Their number in St. Paul, 651-224-4771, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Yes, they can check your AC, and you might have problems with pipes, toilets, and other things still hanging over from the winter, so give them a call. In St. Paul, 651-224-4771, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at ryanplumbing.com. We are talking about manufacturing in this podcast, and the truth of the matter is, when we talk about comparative advantage, the truth of the matter is that many companies are finding it better now to manufacture in the United States, which is very, very interesting. If this is you and you want to bring your manufacturing back to the U.S., let me recommend DepoStar, American Design Engineering and Manufacturing. Visit them online at DepoStar.com. That's DepoStar, DepoStar.com. I want to say this, most of this whole podcast is really food for thought. Most of the time when I hear people talking about China, when I hear political rhetoric about China, I don't really hear a discussion of the history of trade in China, even in a, you know, really collapsed, telescoped way that I just did. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, we're going to talk about trade a little bit and some trade concepts. And I think these should be starting points for what we think about when we think about China. So as I said, the end of the era of monarchy began in the early 1900s. And it's important because the economic system that monarchy operated under throughout Europe and the world was mercantilism. Although I've always said mercantilism, it's mercantilism, according to the dictionary. Anyway, mercantilism is the economic theory that trade generates wealth and is stimulated by the accumulation of profitable balances, which a government should encourage by means of protection. So it's all about the currency balances that you're running, basically. Economists Adam Smith and David Ricardo were the first to challenge the pillars of mercantilism or mercantilism. Both believed in free markets and the idea that governments should not intervene in those markets. Adam Smith's ideas about comparative advantage are still at the root of free trade agreements, although I think David Ricardo did a lot of work along those lines too. So what is comparative advantage? Well, this is the idea that an economy's ability to produce goods and services at a lower opportunity cost than that of trade partners is a factor. A comparative advantage gives a company the ability to sell goods and services at a lower price than its competitors and realize stronger sales margins. To understand comparative advantage, you have to understand opportunity cost, which is not as simple as producing goods cheaper. Put simply, an opportunity cost is the potential benefit that someone loses out on when selecting a particular option over another. So basic business decisions, right? The main takeaway here is this. So-called free trade agreements in the last 60 years, at least, were designed to break down trade barriers in other countries, not necessarily the United States. Now, to be fair, most countries, including the United States, have trade policies that have been and will continue to be a mix of open trade and trade protection. It's a constant yin and yang with trade policy depending on which political party that you're in. The Republicans originally were free traders. Now they've become trade protectionists. The Democrats used to be trade protectionists. I'm not sure where they stand on a lot of this currently, but I would say that in general, the Democrats tend to be more free trade oriented. Isn't that interesting? So the U.S. financed its government back in the day with tariffs, and they did this for eons. We have had our own disastrous experiments with trade protection as well, and I want to talk specifically, because it's so important in terms of late history, the Smoot-Hawley Trade Act of 1930. Now, Smoot-Hawley increased 900 import tariffs by an average of 40% to 48%. Most economists blame it for worsening the Great Depression and also contributing to the start of World War II. And this is at a time when the Republicans were so-called isolationists, Fortress America, and so forth. But since the end of World War II, we, the United States, has sought more open trade with agreements that broke down trade barriers in other countries. Remember, at the end of the war, we had 40% of the, you know, and I say by the end of the war, I mean through 1946 on to 1960. By the time we reached 1960, we had 40% of the world's trade. So we wanted to trade with other countries because it benefited us as well. We wanted to sell our goods in countries that wouldn't allow us to. So the whole regime, the whole experience of trade agreements has been to break down trade barriers in other countries, which tended to be more mercantilists than the United States, even back when we were financing things with tariffs. So it was inevitable that as the rest of the world recovered from World War II, there would be competition for the United States, especially with these agreements in place. In the decades between the 1960s, 1970s, and then even in the 1980s, American companies suffered sometimes withering competition from first Europe, then Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and so forth. Each of these countries, as they came on and they began to trade, if they reduced trade barriers, we all remember the Volkswagen Beetle, if you grew up in the 60s and 70s, and how they were, you couldn't buy a German car because they were very expensive. And then here comes the Beetle. And it was, I don't know, $1,200 or less. So then that car became, you know, popular because of it. And then there was a whole spate of cars, English cars, German cars, and eventually Japanese cars. And we learned the hard way, especially with Japan, that we not only overvalued the quality of what we made, we also discovered to our dismay that for various reasons, some people blame unions, other people blame just paying workers more, but unions definitely had a factor, were a factor in especially the auto industry. We produced things like steel and cars at a very high cost and not always at the best quality. So whether it was Korea on steel or Japan on steel, or Japan on tires, or Japan on cars, or Europe on cars, and other types of things, we learned at a very tough lesson, and that was that we were uncompetitive when it came to many things in the 1980s. And a lot of it had to do with cost, but also a lot of it had to do with overbuilt overhired middle management, especially at our big, you know, companies. So what happened was we created very low opportunity costs, inevitably, for companies in other countries to compete in all the sectors we dominated. So then enter the Russia-U.S. standoff of the 1960s, the nuclear standoff. We all remember that. And when Richard Nixon became president, he acted on the belief that we could coax an isolated communist China, which was starving at the time, into the West as a counterweight to Russian expansion. And certainly China was an international player because they'd already tested a hydrogen bomb. But China at that point became an international economic player. Deng Xiaoping, as we all remember, is the father of China's exceptional economic growth from the late 1970s. But what you need to understand about China is they are not free traders. China is more mercantilist than capitalist. What about the idea that China steals American technology? Well, they do. And it's certainly a problem. It's a problem that's come up in these trade agreements, which are extremely complex. Foreign trade, just in the research for this podcast, I will tell you, if you look up foreign trade, you're going to understand Even if you go to the Census Bureau and you're trying to, so if you go to census documents to try to assess U.S. trading partners, there are so many, there are tons of different categories of foreign trade and different regimes of foreign trade and different foreign trade agreements with different nations. This is a very complex thing. So when somebody says we should do this, or they try to winnow this down to rhetoric, foreign trade doesn't really winnow down to rhetoric because of its complexity. Anyway, so it's fair to say that, yes, China steals American technology. We've been trying to address it for many years in foreign trade agreements and by suing them and so forth at the World Trade Organization, and also legally, you know, through other means. But it's also true that the United States pretty much stole the Industrial Revolution from England, and that is true, and the U.S. still engages in commercial espionage. This doesn't necessarily give us, or China, or any other country that engages in industrial espionage, a comparative advantage. It might give them an advantage in a short term. It might give them technology they can use in their defense industry, things of that nature, which really isn't the subject of this podcast so much as it's to understand that really what's operating here is comparative advantage. And as an emerging economic and military superpower, yes, China is a rival to the United States. Our president seems to be spoiling for confrontation with China, whether it's his talk about trade issues or blaming coronavirus on the Chinese, which there's no proof of currently. Doesn't mean there won't be, but right now there isn't. And so people are starting to talk about the president really, you know, this brinkmanship that he's engaging in, really risking war with China. And the fact is coronavirus raises the stakes a little bit. And so the risk of war with China is significant. It's not critical, but I think it's a significant issue. And the question is, do in this dispute about China and trying to get China to box up all the jobs they took away from us in the 1970s and 80s, which isn't true, they're going to box them back and send them back to us. The truth is that, just as an aside, one of the things that really eliminated jobs in the United States was automation. There's some disagreement about that with research, but I think that it's, for example, I mean, I look at the steel industry, which, you know, for years you had, and I often talk about Pittsburgh, where there were 7,000 and 8,000 guys, or the U.S. Steel Works at Gary, 7,000 or 8,000 guys working 24 hours a day. And you can produce much more steel today with like 17 guys compared to what you used to need to produce steel in the 1950s and 40s and early 60s in the United States. The other truth is the comparative advantage for Chinese-owned companies is being reduced by other Asian, Latin American, and Eastern European competitors. And companies in those countries are beginning to say there's a comparative advantage in competing with the Chinese. The biggest bugaboo for the Chinese right now is Vietnam, for example. When you add technology and quality to the mix, well, then the cost of China's mercantilist approach and social safety nets are also being a factor. Then the opportunity cost equation starts to change. Now, China and the U.S. can trade with any country, any company. And then there's all these questions about value-added products. For example, we import parts to make MRI machines. So we import parts to make MRI machines and then export the MRI machine, which is a very sophisticated, you know, piece of medical equipment. We import parts from other countries to make and assemble cars in the United States. BMW assembles cars in the United States. You know, you can argue that every car is an import because there is no car made anywhere in the world with parts that are exclusively made in the country where that car is being quote unquote assembled or made. So when we talk about trade just in the automotive industry, and this is true in other kinds of industry, you know, the things that you're making doesn't necessarily mean that all the parts and the components of what you're making have to come from the country that you're in to say, we made that in Mexico or we made that in China. In fact, in 2019, I was surprised to learn that our number one foreign trade partner was not China, it was Mexico and Canada. And there might be other reasons for that, but this is how trade is so complex. Also, this trade deficit issue is also very complex because this is a factor. Really, my understanding is it's really an artifact of how we measure trade. So, and part of it is just what I explained to you, that you import parts and then you assemble something and export that thing, right? So right now you hear a lot about how China owns all the US debt. This is another big issue. Well, don't they own all of our debt? And the answer is no, first of all. Second of all, how does a foreign investor buy US debt? And people say, we're indebted to the Chinese. Well, we're not. We didn't borrow our money from the Bank of China, essentially. What they do is they buy U.S. debt in the form of treasuries, billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of treasury with dollars they cannot spend in China because, as you know, China has its own currency. They also buy real estate and American goods as well. The largest holder of U.S. securities is the American public, not a foreign country, and it's substantial. It's also the Federal Reserve and other U.S. interests that own U.S. securities and buy the most U.S. securities. And when I say securities, I'm talking about T-bills. China is often the largest foreign investor in U.S. Treasury, but not always. The U.K., Saudi Arabia, and other top U.S. trading partners also figure prominently. Why? Because we buy that stuff with dollars. And then they have those dollars and they can't spend those dollars in their country. So what do? They buy U.S. securities. China, with an aging population of 1.3 billion, is entering a critical time in its expansion from a developing nation to a mature modern state with a mature modern economy. And this is where their mercantilism will begin to sort of whittle down that comparative advantage because the costs involved with maintaining that become difficult. They've gone from a developing nation, as I said, to a modern state. The Communist Party will struggle to hold on to power in a world where 6% GDP growth is going to be increasingly difficult to maintain simply because of the size of the economy and the age of China's citizens, especially with competition from their neighbors and the rest of the world. And let's not forget Japan. And let's not forget, by the way, Japan is also one of the major investors in U.S. treasuries. Let's not forget Eastern Europe. Let's not forget Germany. Let's not forget Latin America. These are, and parts of Africa where countries are beginning to develop. This is why China is so interested in Latin America. This is why China is so interested in Africa, as well as the United States, as well as Europe. Finally, once in a generation, events like the Spanish flu in 1918 and the coronavirus almost exactly 100 years later have a way of clarifying and even triggering revolution and war in the rest of the world. There's a lot being written right now about tracing the growth of fascism in Europe to the results of the quote-unquote Spanish flu, which, by the way, they called it the Spanish flu, but it actually started in Kansas. So it should be called the Kansas flu. Yes, it is true. U.S. doughboys in training in Kansas were the first people that caught the flu. They went over to Europe with the flu, and they spread the flu in Europe. Eventually, it ended up in Spain, and the big outbreak occurred in Spain, hence the name the Spanish flu. But it really was the Kansas flu. Wars that end regimes and systems of governments are the result of this kind of really dangerous situation because they can end up triggering revolution and war in different parts of the world. In a war with China, the United States and whatever countries ally with us and with China, if it comes to that, will not escape severe damage, no matter what we do. And so we will be in a situation not dissimilar to what Europe was in at the end of World War II. We will not have the advantage of having factories running 24 hours a day to be able to take advantage of whatever is left over after we have a war with China. This is not something that we want to do. And in the final analysis, I would just say this. So my take on this is this. I think China is a lot weaker than we are willing to admit. I think they are really at a critical stage of their development. We are very lucky to have been able to buy cheap products from China. There's definitely an opportunity cost and an opportunity gain in terms of years and years and years of people being able to buy products that used to cost, you know, a toaster that cost $12 instead of $62, for example. Things like that, it's almost incalculable in terms of the wealth effect of something like that. But I will say this. In this kind of a situation, coronavirus, bellicose words and statements, leadership that is proven weak or unnecessarily bellicose or even unpredictable does not fare well in this kind of environment. On top of coronavirus, we do not want a war with China, and we don't want a trade war with China. Just food for thought. We've been inside. You know, we are still, even though people are starting to disobey, it's pretty hard to hold people down. We've been in our houses. And so if you've been in the house, you've been looking around the house, and you've been spending a lot of time in the house, and maybe this is the year. You're finally going to decide to finish off the basement, get the kids down there to get them out of your hair, or the garage for man caves, or a new kitchen or bathroom. And for that, let me recommend Whitetail Builders in Andover, Minnesota. Randy Grabo, his favorite thing is to redo kitchens, and you would not believe what he can do. I mean, even the most basic thing. They got all their equipment so they can work safely in your home with the coronavirus thing, and they're available for you to talk to regardless of what you're doing in your house. And they will be with you every step of the way to meet your expectations, no matter what it is. So here's the deal. Call Randy Grabo. He loves to talk to people about what they're doing. 612-282-8801. That's 612-282-8801. Whitetail Builders of Andover, Minnesota. Check them out online at whitetailbuildersinc.com or click on the Whitetail banner at the top of the page at the bobdavispodcasts.com. And I still hate my printer because I hate paying for print cartridges. That is why Cartridge World rules. They can save you up to 30% compared to the big box stores. If you qualify, they can get you a free printer. If you qualify, they can do free delivery and qualifying orders. And of course, they do curbside service at Cartridge World in Maple Grove off of Weaver Lake Road between Dairy Queen and Subway. Metro wide for Maple Grove. 763-420-6632 or click on the banner that says Cartridge World at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. So, yeah, the trade thing is very complex. I wish I had more time to go through the history, but I think it gives you a general perspective, and these are some things to think about before you just swallow the rhetoric whole. Thanks for listening to Podcast 924. Let's talk about China. I'm floating down a river. Freed from their holes long ago, lying face up on the floor of my vessel. I marvel at the stars and feel my heart overflow.